Well, that takes us on to sort of the golden age musicals. Now, these are shows that I think a lot of people have heard of, maybe know the scores of, like Carmen Jones, Lost in the Stars, and Golden Boy. What can you tell us about Black musical theater moving into the golden age?
Well, during this period, Black musical theater, I guess, comes in two forms. There's Black authored musical theater, and right. there are musicals about Black individuals or African-American life that are authored by white authors.
Right.
So as we were talking about earlier, there was this boom of Black authored musicals in the 1920s and leading into the 30s. And then as we get into the golden age, as it's called, I define the golden age as 1931 through 70. But so as we were getting into the golden age, however one chooses to define it, we start to see the disappearance of Black authored musicals. And I think there are a number of reasons.
Well, why do you think that is?
Well, first of all, as we get into the 30s, we're in the Depression. The right. theater scene starts to contract.
Sure.
And, as a result of that, but tangentially throughout the 20s, prices are going, cost of production is going up.
Right.
These three things are serving to really contract the quote unquote Broadway stage into right. what it ultimately will become, what it is, now in terms of the modern Broadway stage. So a byproduct of that is of course, is opportunity. So opportunity is narrowing. I think in terms of content and form, on the other side, that is advancing. So you have a form that is maturing, there's a sophistication that's developing, there's an adventurousness that is being infused in terms of integration of dance into shows or really sharp wit and social consciousness becomes a major element mm-hmm. when we enter mm-hmm. the 30s. And I think as a purely objective statement with no sort of prescription as to why, looking at the Black authored shows as we go into the 30s, most of them are not on the forefront of this burgeoning form or this advancing form.
Right.
Most of them are, as written, again, this is sort of an objective assessment of the shows as written, are of the more prescriptive 1920s floor show variety.
Right. Right.
That being objective, I think the subjective element is, one, the social dynamics of the country did not offer tremendous opportunity to these Black artists to be able to mature their craft or to be able
sure.
to advance in the way that, Oscar Hammerstein had his own personal heritage, but then he was under the tutelage of Otto Harbach. So there was
right.
this, that's one specific instance, but there was this
right.
line, this lineage that was not there in terms of, or not, there was not necessarily opportunity for it for these
right.
Black
there was no infrastructure for a Black authored musical.
Right, right. So that, I think that sort of stunts the progression of Black musical theater in a way through,
mm-hmm.
Not through the fault of the artists themselves necessarily, but there's this this lack of opportunity, and then as the form is advancing, you want writers who are going to advance the form, and so I think there's many things at play and not sort of one specific instance, but
well,
it becomes
is
a
this
world
also
of
the rise of the Chitlin Circuit. Is this...
This would have been, yeah, I feel like that was... Well, because this was vaudeville. That would have been circa 1920s, I want to say.
Okay.
But I don't have the specific dates on that, but it would have
been...
No,
I'm just wondering if it's one of those things where it starts to develop outside of Broadway.
Interesting. There were attempts, and I think there was a Black musical theater outside of Broadway,
sure.
But it, you know, it, the it was not prominent. And even in the late 20s, there was an article by, I think it's Irvin Miller, who's the brother of Flournoy Miller, of Miller and Lyles. Mm-hmm. I believe it's him. I would want to check to be certain. But it was a prominent Black artist, I believe it was Irvin Miller, who, even in the late 20s, was acknowledging the fact that Black musicals are not up to snuff, as it were. And oh, really? So Black audiences would rather patronize a white musical or a white musical house as opposed to supporting quote-unquote Black musicals because, you know, a number of factors went into that in terms of not having resources or right. time or, you know. But essentially, the Black musical theater was not advancing in the way it should, as acknowledged by the artists actually working in it.
Right.
So even, you know, when you get into the 30s and 40s, there are still Black musicals and there's Black musical theater. And to keep pointing back to Miller, actually, Flournoy Miller and U.B. Blake, mm-hmm. there was a show called Tan Manhattan, it was either 40 or 41. I believe it started in D.C. They were promoting it as being the next Shuffle Along, you know, the new Shuffle sure. Along, the greatest yeah. thing in 20 years. Right. And, you know, it doesn't reach New York because it's not, you know, it is just, it's still of this 1920s
right.
Prescription, you know. So for better or worse, again, not no assessment right. on the quality, obviously, of, or the talent of the individuals. It just as a musical piece, it did not, it was not advancing in the way that the musical stage in general was. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so the majority of musicals about African American life start to be written by white authors. And so you have, the one that I think, or I really point to as sort of a major beginning of that. That's obviously not a definitive beginning, but is Porgy and Bess.
Sure.
Which is 1935.
Sure.
And then we have the some of, you know, the shows that are in the exhibit, actually. Carmen Jones is right. Oscar Hammerstein. And Hazard Short, I'll mention, the director, who's a genius and visionary.
Agreed.
And totally forgotten.
Yes.
And then Lost in the Stars, which is Maxwell Anderson, Kurt Vile, and Ruben Mamoulian, who was also connected right. to Hammerstein, okay. incidentally.
Sure. Sure.
And then Golden Boy, which is Strauss and Adams and a whole bunch of people because it was having great difficulty on the road. But, right. you know, so these are, you know, and some of them are quite, both quite good and really aspirational. I think Lost in the Stars, for one, I don't find it to be a wholly successful show, but I think it's really thoughtful and very seriously executed.
Right. Right.
If not, you know, it doesn't work in toto. I think it's really a serious attempt.
Right.
For which I have great respect. But then I think on the other hand, you move towards, you know, Golden Boy is not a bad show by any means, but it's, you know, it just is much more troubled.
Well, I think you, in both the cases of Lost in the Stars and Carmen Jones, you have white creative team who are really anxious to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. They may not know how to do it and why they don't actually bring in Black people to help them do it is another question. But they definitely were interested in, I mean, Hammerstein had been a failure for essentially a decade before Oklahoma. He becomes a huge success. And the first thing he does is an all Black Carmen. It just seems like such a wild thing for him to do.
Quick interjection.
Yeah.
Carmen Jones was actually written before Oklahoma.
No, I understand. Understand that.
Oh, okay.
I understand that.
Got it. Okay.
But that it gets produced. I mean, he can do anything
the first,
he wants.
The next what production of Hammerstein. Yeah.
What does he want to do? He wants to do this, and Billy Rose, of course, says Oscar Hammerstein's doing it. It's going to be great. Whereas a year ago, he could have pitched it, and Billy Rose would have said that is insane. You know. Right. So why he wants to do that? I think he wants. he wants to tell the story. He wants to shine a light into the Black community. And you know, he did a lot of work both in Hollywood and on the East Coast to deal with racial tensions. You know, they were also very anti-fascist, you know, anti-racist. You know, he led organizations that were about that. You know, out in Bucks County, he would join the with Pearl Buck and starting Welcome House to bring in American children and Asian children to be adopted in this country. So he, I mean, I think he was very sincere, but it just it's just amazing to me that these white guys would think, let's do these Black shows and not bring in any Black creative people to help them realize their vision.
Well, I agree. I think the one of the answers, or one of the potential answers, is it was a different time.
Of course.
I think, yeah. But it is a question that will linger.
I mean, it's what I find so incredible is that all these voices of Black cartoon characters are all of a sudden now being recast because, you know, in light of all the demonstrations, there's feeling like, oh, we have to have Black people do these. And it's like, why wouldn't you have Black people do those in the first place? I mean, it just doesn't seem, it seems bizarre that you would have white people doing Black characters in an animated series like The Simpsons. Just crazy.
In this day and age.
Yeah, in this day and age, yeah. Right. Because these are not insensitive people. But, you know, it's just, there it is. That's the way of the industry. You know, doesn't consider the Black actor or the Black designer or the Black director. You know, for I mean, for years, if you wanted a Black director on Broadway, it was Lloyd Richards. Like he was the guy, and now
George Wolfe. Now, or not now, but post him, George Wolfe. Yeah,
right,
yeah.
Exactly. And that to me, I mean, you have other people. You have Billy Wilson and people like that, but. It is amazing to me that there's such an inherent prejudice against Black creative people in the theater and across the board in the entertainment world.
And I would keep pointing to opportunity too, because I think also it starts with education and access to the entertainment world.
Absolutely.
So that, you know, so there is, yeah. And I just feel like there's, I can't speak to the, what to the state now, you know, or, and more recently as we're changing. But certainly in the period in which we're discussing and general sort of mid and even into the later 20th century, I do think it's the, you know, it's access to opportunity. And then later when we start, especially on the playwright side, and we'll talk about it later, but the JOPAP and other smaller institutions start to give opportunity to young playwrights, and then we see more, a bit more African-American authors.
Well, I mean, so let's talk about something like the Negro Ensemble Company, mm-hmm. you know, which was such a crucial place for Black playwrights, Black directors, Black actors to really hone their craft, mm-hmm. and they start to take shows to Broadway. I mean, they're down at the St. Mark's Playhouse, it's Douglas Turner Ward who writes an article. He's in, but they're I forget what show they're doing down there, and the Times asks him to write a piece on the state of Black theater in America. And when he writes this piece, the Ford Foundation, and one of the things he talks
Robert
about.
Robert Hooks, I think.
No, it's
Robert
Douglas
Hooks
Turner
who
Ward.
Wrote the... Oh,
no,
okay.
It's Ward. It's Ward who wrote the Hooks. Piece. And he, at least as I read it, maybe I have it wrong.
No,
I'm pretty sure it was Ford. And after he writes it, the Ford, you know, he writes this article where it talks about having a Black repertory theater. And the Ford Foundation comes to him. What is this, like 65, I think? And says, we'll underwrite it, you know, which is an amazing thing. You know, I doubt we'd see that today, but it's because of that that they get the money to start the Negro Ensemble Company, which is certainly the biggest, it seems to me, the biggest incubator for Black theater makers in the second half of the 20th century.
I mean,
so many playwrights, performers, directors, and designers come out of, I mean, the Negro Ensemble companies, a part of their resume, a part of where they got their start, because it didn't exist before. I mean, you had the Lafayette Players and the Lafayette Theater and all that.
American Negro Theater. Yeah.
But it really, it's Negro Ensemble seems to really play a very important role. But feel free to disagree with me.
No, I don't disagree. I totally agree. Very important role. I don't know. I would say, indeed, absolutely. I think the other major players, I think, are the Public Theater and Joe Papp, who is very supportive of minority writers, both black and female, and black females.
Right.
And then I think later Playwrights Horizons too, starts to develop, I think, I'm going through my Rolodex of origins. So I'm trying to, I'm like, oh wait, where was it? Who was there?
Well, and that's, you have to come up, you start thinking about everybody's resumes and where shows work. Right. I know how that is.
But certainly the Negro Ensemble Company, the same year that they started, it's a small organization, but called Urban Arts Corps, which was part of the Ghetto Arts Program of the New York State Council on the Arts. This is Vinette Carroll's organization.
Right.
And to my mind, she is one of the most instrumental forces in terms of the Black resurgence in her case, principally musical theater, but then also, Black theater, generally speaking, toward the end of the civil rights movement and then going into the 70s. Because she has the Urban Arts Corps, which is geared toward fostering the talent and training individuals who are basically high school and college age.
Right.
Which is wonderful on its own. I think even more significant than that is her success as a Black female director in the 60s and going into the 70s, and also her fostering of a couple major musical pieces which are part of this Black revival. Don't Bother Me, I Can't Cope is hers, and with score by Mickey Grant, so I'm not gonna, let's not discount Mickey Grant, but it's Vinette Carroll who is the driving force on that, as she is on Your Arms Too Short. And she really starts in the 60s, even early 60s, before Negro Ensemble, before there's really a resurgence of Black theater, generally speaking, certainly Black musical theater, with Trumpets of the Lord, James Weldon Johnson. Oh well, this goes ties it back. James Weldon Johnson adaptation.
And when was that? When was that show?
It started off Broadway in, I believe, 63, and then it did not go anywhere. It went on a small tour, I believe, and I believe they played overseas, but it didn't land on Broadway until, I want to say, 69. It might be 68, but it was 69, which is when, late 60s is when the really commercial, that's a better word for it, when the commercial Black resurgence started.
Right.
Because you had in 67, David Merrick, producer, brought Pearl Bailey and the all-Black Dolly to their Broadway house.
Right.
You had Robert Hooks in Hallelujah Baby that year.
Yeah, sure.
Who would then leave to do, as you mentioned, Negro Ensemble Company. And then after that you have Hair coming out, by Black authors, but a social movement. And Vinette Carroll is then on Broadway, I think it's 69, when Trumpets actually makes it to Broadway. And then I think it's either 1 or 2 years later, she's back with Don't Bother Me, I Can't Cope, which becomes really a massive a massive hit, a massive right. black musical, not, you know, without dissecting the fundamentals of it, just on, you know, on its face, it is a commercial, a major commercial success, as is Melvin right. Van Peebles piece, which comes out, I think, the same year, I want to say. Might be, you know, give or take 1 year.
Right.
But anyway, so Vinette Carroll is, I think, really as in terms of a single individual, really an instrumental force. Certainly not the, you know, she didn't have the organizational hold as the Negro Ensemble Company, which right. you know launched a number of writers and moved to Broadway a number of times, and
right.
and Joe Papp as well, who, you know, right. had.
Well, they had organizations. They had very good institutional support and organizational support. And I think that made all the difference. I mean, the Negro Ensemble Company, I don't think they bring it to Broadway, but it's a big off-Broadway hit, the musical The Great Mac Daddy.
Yes, Circa 75, which I was not deeply familiar, I must confess.
Oh, really?
So it was interesting to read about that. A couple, and I haven't, this is totally not relevant, but there's
that's
another
what we're
show
all about that, here, not relevant.
Not relevant, yes. There's another show that your exhibition turned me onto, which I was not aware of, which is an Ed Bullins musical.
Oh, called, no kidding.
Called Sepia Star. So wow. I have no idea what that is, but I look forward to investigating it.
That's money in the bank. You get to go there sometime, take it out and see what it is. No, well, Bullins is another important figure who comes out of, again, a political climate. You know, he at one time is the Minister of Culture for the Black Panther Party. He gets involved with the Black Arts Movement and becomes really sort of the best known playwright to come out of that, and sort of the most articulate one to come
and
out.
And yet, perhaps one of the least remembered.
Oh, yeah.
Coincidentally. You know, doesn't...
You know.
Yes, yeah. But doesn't he's someone that I was learning about as a result of the exhibit. So I can't speak with any definition about his whole story, but I was interested to learn his trajectory, his history, and then the fact that he never really, at least seemingly on paper, never really broke through in the way that some of his contemporaries ultimately did during that same period.
Right. I think
in terms of prominence.
Right, exactly. I mean, he's sort of always been on the fringes. But I think you also pointed out that it's fascinating that he and August Wilson both do these cycles of 20th century African-American experience.
Yeah.
This cycle of plays. And while I haven't seen any of Bullins, of course, I've seen a number of August Wilson's, there's obviously a feeling that this needs to be addressed. You know, the story of the Black people in the 20th century, and in a way, that's what The Great Mac Daddy is also talking about. I mean, it's doing it in a musical
way. Apparently a much more obtuse and sort of fantastical way, based on what I've read.
Any show that has Stag Lee in it and the signifying monkey, and that's okay in my book. I'm all for it.
Okay. Revival coming soon.
Yeah, it has been revived. You know, it has been revived. Well, the other Negro Ensemble company shows, just so we can sort of tie a bow on that we have in the exhibition are Douglas Turner Ward when he was in the Brownsville Raid. I don't know the Brownsville Raid, but we included that draw. Excuse me, because it was Douglas Turner Ward, who I think is just such an important figure in the story. He's not the only figure, and I'm sure he has perhaps a higher opinion of his involvement than everybody else, but he does play a very significant role. And then the other drawing we have from the Negro Ensemble Company is Home, with Charles Brown and...
L. Scott Caldwell.
Right.
And Michelle Shea.
Michelle Shea.
Who later again, does a Wilson.
Yeah, what was that?
Who later does a Wilson play.
Oh, no kidding. Oh, right, of course. So, I mean, it's interesting to me. They are, you know, it takes them years to be bringing shows regularly to Broadway, but there's an audience, obviously, there. Home plays, I think, for 2 years. It has a pretty decent run. And again, it tells a story that is a uniquely Black story, as opposed to, you know, Anna LaCosta was a sort of switch out from, it's a Black family, it's a Polish-American family, what difference does it make? Whereas what the Negro Ensemble Company is doing are specifically plays about the Black experience.
I think we should add, not to qualify though, one over the other.
Right,
one
right.
scenario over the other. Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Right. No, I'm just saying unfortunately, it's unusual. When we look at 20th century American theater, we need to talk about it only because if they weren't doing it, while there were other companies that were doing it, they were maybe the biggest company doing it, and they had the most success as a company. As a company, but that's not to say that there weren't others and very important figures. Like Ed Bullins, August Wilson, who Ed Bullins is an doesn't come out of the Negro Ensemble Company, but I believe August Wilson does a playwright workshop there.
Oh, interesting.
So I think that they have a connection to a lot of the Black performers that more in straight plays than in musicals per se. But they're a real, as I said, incubator for that on Broadway, off Broadway, and the American theater in general.
Right.
I want to also talk about the music. You know, in the 1970s, things are changing. You know, all across Broadway, there's this embrace of nostalgia. You know, which manifests itself in No, No, Nanette, and you know, the revivals of that, and the revival
and 452 other revivals. Yes.
and even the new musicals of the decade. You know,
Grease.
Yeah, right, yes, Greece. Yeah. I mean, and
over there.
Yeah.
No, over here, rather. Over here.
Right. I mean, it's it is amazing. And I think there's a lot of factors, you know, the ongoing Vietnam War, the economic issues, you get the oil crisis. People want to go back to a time when they felt was a better time, and they embrace this nostalgia.
Which it has a little mirror of the 20s,
yes,
and into the 30s too, because there's this wave of revivals in the 20s. The Schuberts are part of some of them, but I remember there's a Babes and Victor Herbert operettas are being revived, yeah, amidst the jazz, you know, the jazz age, yes, is going mad. And then there's a very successful revival of Floridora from 1900.
Right.
So it's in, yeah.
What is interesting, though, in the 70s is how does it manifest itself in sort of for Black theater. Billy Wilson, the director, is a very decent success with Bubbling Brown Sugar with Vivian Reed. And what does he choose?
Which is a nostalgia piece, too.
Yes, exactly. What does he choose as his next project? But Guys and Dolls, which just sort of blows my mind because it's not a white person show, but everybody, it's always done that way. And so when I came across the drawing of the Black Guys and Dolls, I was astounded. I didn't know if it was a joke at first. I had to research it. I was fascinated by it. And of course, it's an incredible production.
Oh my God.
It has all the great people.
I would love to have seen that. Yeah. Robert, I think, is it pronounced Guillaume? I don't want to mispronounce his name, but the lead actor was well known on television. Say it again?
Robert Guillaume.
Is that how it is?
I would say Guillaume, but.
Guillaume.
That's what Guillaume. I said, but I could be totally wrong.
No, I think you're right.
I would say Guillaume.
Yeah.
Anyway, he is just. I love him. I would have loved to have seen him in that.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
I would have loved to have seen him as Sporting Life in Porgy and Bess in 64. Another great role that he played. And
interesting. I didn't love him in Pearly.
Oh,
but
really?
That's just, that could be just me. I speak only for myself.
Well, there's going to be a certain contingent who listens to this, who grew up in the 70s and early 80s, who will remember him as he's like a butler on Soap, this TV show, and then eventually gets his sort of own show.
Yeah.
And that's how most of America really sort of discovered him. But he'd already been around, obviously, for a while.
Right.
We've got to give it to the people at Frank Lesser, probably Joe Sullivan Lesser, for allowing a Black Guys and Dolls, which are hardly revolutionary, but very unusual for the time. One of the other big nostalgia Black theater-wise productions in the 70s is this little review that the Manhattan Theater Club puts together for five performers and use primarily the music of Fats Waller that turns into an incredible hit called Ain't Misbehavin'.
Yes. And potentially, fun fact, Richard, but I say potentially, yeah. It may not be fun, but Richard Maltby, who conceived and put that show together, who is white, since we're talking colors here, let's just,
sure.
We should just voice that. Neither here nor there, not yes. an assessment. I was speaking with him at one time about generally and specifically then about this show, and you had said a small show for five, or you said a show for five performers, and I believe, Richard, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe he told me that they had initially conceived the show for four performers, and then when they were in auditions, these two women came in and he couldn't decide between them, so he made it a five performer piece.
Wow.
Oh, no kidding. And that doesn't include Luther Henderson on the piano.
Oh, genius arranger, who was also on No No Nanette, who did the George C. Wolfe musicals later. Brilliant, just a brilliant gentleman.
No, I couldn't agree with you more. But he is sort of like the guy you don't hear about with Ain't Misbehavin'. The drawing we have in the show, although Hirschfeld did draw the original 1978 production, it was part of a composite with other shows opening that week. So we chose the 1988 revival, which was the original cast. And he would not only do that cast drawing, but he did these Friday theater column drawings. And so Ken Page, Nell Carter, Amela McQueen are all shown in those as well, individual portraits of the performers. It's obviously something that he enjoyed and of course was a big hit. I mean, it's a very big hit.
Major hit, yeah.
Yeah. But again, a show that's looking back rather than necessarily looking forward.
Yeah, oh, totally, yeah. A melding of the nostalgia and the Black 70s resurgence, yeah. And Timbuktu, I don't know if there's a drawing of it. I know it's not in the
exhibit,
the kit in Timbuktu. And
in fact, the Hirschfeld drawing would be used as the program cover.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Great one.
Yeah, no, a Hirschfeld drawing, I say in the introduction to the show, Hirschfeld did about 50 show posters over 60 years, probably more than anybody else who wasn't doing it, you know, specifically. And his first one was for Swingin' the Dream with Louis Armstrong, showing Louis Armstrong and Benny Goodman playing while Shakespeare dances above them. And his last one was Having Our Say with two older Black actresses. And so we don't think of Hirschfeld as the artist that you would go to, but he was frequently, when Carmen Jones went on the road, they used the Hirschfeld drawing on the cover of the program. I don't know how
you were
many
saying something else about, you had told me, Duke Ellington, I think, did you say?
We have a story on our website where where in 1931, Duke Ellington was going on his first national tour, and his management realized that to place a photograph of a black performer in a Midwest newspaper was going to be very difficult. So they thought if they had Hirschfeld do a drawing of Duke Ellington, everybody would want to run that, not because he was Hirschfeld, but because the drawings were engaging. And they wrote in the press kit that these are drawings that major metropolitan newspapers, i.e. white, ran. And it was very successful. I mean, the drawing was run much, much more than any of the photographs provided. And in fact, so much so that other artists would copy Hirschfeld's drawing. I don't want to say we don't want to make any crazy claims for Hirschfeld, but he did play his own role, and he would play a role. He would have his input into the black theater experience in America because his drawings were so often a part of them. You know, these big productions like Timbuktu, like Carmen Jones, like Having Our Say, and all these different shows that he did posters and programs for. Became part of the black theater experience in America. I want to talk about a couple of other ones. You know, we touched on Joe Papp, but we really didn't talk about the public theater. And I don't think you can tell the story of black theater history in America without talking about For Colored Girls. That was such an important show all the way around, you know, I think for the people in it and for the people who saw it. And it too would go to Broadway and be a much bigger hit, you know, much bigger hit than even the other big shows of that time. It opens the same season as a Neil Simon show and I forget what else, but it runs longer than all those. And Hirschfeld does, I think, an incredible drawing that sort of shows us all the performers, but doesn't reveal any of the story, but it gives you a sense of what the performance was like.
Mm-hmm. I think interesting to your point about the significance of it, I find it also telling that a number of critics or commentators would, in their stories, articles, or reviews, whatever the respective mode was, reference a chorus line. Which had opened just prior to that,
right?
So that, I mean, just in terms of the how mammoth or significant the piece was,
right. Well, and the other show that we have in the exhibition that is also a public theater production is No Place to Be Somebody, which we considered for a title of the exhibition. This was a drawing that Hirschfeld did not do when the show was in its original run, which was in 1967. In 1973, Brooks Atkinson and Hirschfeld collaborated on a book called The Lively Years, where Atkinson looked back over the last 50 years of American theater and talked about the plays that were significant, that really captured the zeitgeist and, you know, deserved to be remembered. And one of those was No Place to Be Somebody. Hirschfeld went to his drawings that he did for some of these productions originally, and if he liked them, he just put those in the book. But he did over 50 new drawings for the book, including this one of Nathan George in No Place to Be Somebody. It's the logo, it's the signature image for the show. And I think it's the first time a black writer wins the Pulitzer for drama. Mm. So, you know, it's the public theater. Joe Papp was this white producer who would end up having a pretty big impact on black theater.
A major impact.
Yeah.
And champion definitely. Of playwrights in particular.
Yes.
I think, yeah.
And from all cultures. I mean, he brings in so much. He brings in a much more international flavor, but he also makes sure that the Latinx community is represented, that women are represented, that people of color are represented. It's so unusual because there hadn't been anything quite like that before.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There's something that I was recently researching, tangential to this, it's not in the exhibition, and I don't know if you have a image of it, but his first, I think it was his first season when he took over at Lincoln Center, when he was bringing New York Shakespeare Festival up to Lincoln Center.
Sure.
And the season didn't go well, as I understand it. I think the last production, or the spring production, was supposed to be this black quasi-musical. I don't remember exactly what they called it, but it was a play that had a band in it, but called Black Picture Show, which really fascinated me, written by Bill Gunn, which ultimately he ended up pulling. And he right. substituted right. something else there, and then brought it back. I think it was the next winter, a year later. I guess I found that particularly interesting in that it just further supported his nurturing and belief in playwrights and diversity and sort of and getting people's voices out there, no matter where the location was, because he had these. Plans for Lincoln Center Theater, sure. and he brought this downtown production up to what was effectively a downtown production
sure.
uptown to Lincoln Center, and I there's a very interesting article I was reading, interview with him talking specifically about the difference between downtown and uptown, and I can't remember if it was related to this particular show or if it was talking generally about downtown being a place to grow and a different type of environment, and uptown needing stars. Right. I don't want to misquote him, but it was a very interesting sort of assessment and spoke to his vision and what how he was actually nurturing and workshopping and developing this robust group of talent, both black, white, female, rather diverse body of artists.
No, without a doubt. Well, Lincoln Center he couldn't conquer it, but neither could Ilya Kazan and Arthur Miller and Robert Whitehead. The first 15 years of Lincoln Center Theater is a series of mistakes. And it's so funny to see it. And then Greg Mosier takes over, and within a few years, he's got the revival of Anything Goes, and then House of Blue Leaves. And it makes it a going concern. Joe Papp was defeated by Lincoln Center, like so many had been before. But speaking of Lincoln Center, the last piece in the show, and I want to talk about there's three sort of more contemporary musicals, but since we're talking about Lincoln Center Theater, we might as well talk about the last piece in the show, which is a Lincoln Center Theater production of Marie Christine, starring the incomparable Audra McDonald.
Who is that?
What was that?
Who's she?
I'm not familiar with her.
Audra? Who her?
Oh, that Audra McDonald.
Yeah.
That one.
And of course, she had, I think, really come into people's consciousness. I mean, first Masterclass, but then the Carousel production was
also Lincoln Center, incidentally.
Yeah, no. I remember seeing it and just being, that was a real revelation. You're going along and it's a different type of production of Carousel in the first place. And then she comes out and blows everybody away. And you're like, who is this? Right. So 5 years later, when she's in a show that was written for her, Marie Christine, it was pretty exciting. And while the show isn't 100% successful, it wasn't her problem. It wasn't her fault that it wasn't successful. It was it is a good musical, not a great musical, I guess is what I would put it at. But Audra, of course, would go on to become the most, in many ways, the most awarded performer in Broadway history. Having won, I think she's won like 6 Tonys, performance Tonys, and she's won in all 4 categories, acting categories. Best actress in a musical, best actress in a play, best actress, I forget all the ones that she's won, but she's won them all. It's probably a shorter list to tell you what she didn't win. Hirschfeld only drew Audra twice. In this role, Marie Christine, which was never published by the New York Times. We don't know why. They commissioned it. He did the drawing. It's one can only needs to go to the exhibition and look at the drawing. It's a very nice drawing, but for whatever reason, they didn't run that. The other drawing he did of Audra is in Ragtime. She is not in the drawing of Carousel from 94.
Who is?
The two leads.
Hayden and Sally.
Yes.
Oh my God, I'm forgetting her last name.
Right.
Murphy, Sally Murphy.
Thank you. Yes. I wanted to say Sally Mays, but that would have been totally wrong.
That's another one. Malpy again.
No.
But then the other shows, and perhaps you can tell us more about it, is Grind, the Hal Prince show.
Grind fascinates me, but I've not read the book, so I can't speak to the actual libretto, but I suspect if/when I do read the libretto, I will be disappointed. But some of the score.
Evidently, a lot of theater audiences were.
Yes, yes. I mean, it was apparently not a good show, you know.
Right.
But the some of the score I enjoy, I will say. But essentially, it is set in 1933, I believe, Chicago in a burlesque house.
Right.
And deals with, it's a essentially a race musical. So it's right. Dealing with a segregated burlesque house. And then I believe there's a love triangle involved.
Right.
And it just, as I understand it, it's not wholly a successful piece. I will say I did not see it, I can't speak directly to the production.
Neither have I. And it's one of Hal Prince's failures in the 1980s.
In the 80s, yeah. I think, for me, the most interesting, or maybe not the most interesting piece about it, but something interesting about it, is actually not even the racial aspect. It's the Hal Prince aspect and reinforcing the fact that he was one of the progenitors or one of the sort of at the forefront of this mega musical craze.
Oh, yes.
that happened in the 80s. Because, it starts, I shouldn't say it starts, but his concept of theater as metaphor and his sort of very, and the breadth of his physical productions
right.
begins in the 70s. And then, of course, in the 80s, it is, taken to an extreme then later by a lot of the Weber shows, Trevor Nunn, et cetera. But I think one of the things that was so interesting in reading about Grind was the commentary on the physical production and the elaborateness of the set design and sort of it ended up sort of an example of the result of sort of the expansiveness that happened in the 70s and this quest to be bigger and bigger. And then sort of right. The story seems to have gotten lost in that apparently very elaborate and stunning maze of a set.
Well, I tell a story in the Hirschfeld Century. I think this is maybe the only time Hirschfeld gets an assignment to draw Starlight Express, which to me is sort of the apex of overblown production, where you could have had automatons in there. It could have been in a Disney show for that, with the animatronics, because you were going there for the set and the production and, the songs that could come out of it. But, it's a crazy over-the-top production. Hirschfeld goes to the show and then calls up his editor the next day and says, I declined to do that one. It wasn't for him. And it never... I can't think of any other time where that happened. He turned out to be right because no one else really wanted to deal with it. I mean, the show has a very short run in New York. So he understood that it wasn't any good, at least in what was presented in America. can't say what was going on in England, but what was presented in America. So that except, you know, and he was very skeptical, I would say, of the lavish, the over the top presentation, you know, falling chandeliers and helicopters landing on stage. That didn't do anything for Hirschfeld. I found an interview in the mid 90s where he talks about this. You know, you don't need that. You know, he talks in bringing the noise, bringing the funk. He's like, that's all you need. You need performers and a great show. And you know, he was happy to see that it was going back to simplicity, because he thought that the performer, the character, you know, thought the most important person in the show was the playwright, but then after that it was the performers, and they allowed the performers to shine.
Interesting. Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say to the elaborateness. It's interesting because in a sense, this is the. What the period we're discussing right now is a period in as I identify in the book, I call it growing pains or identity crisis. And it's fascinating that I think many people, and perhaps at the time, I can't speak to the state of mind at the time, but think that this is sort of, you know, the mega musical is born and things are growing and it is this new spectacle. And right. Yet actually it's really a throwback to 70 years earlier.
Yes.
When, you know, they're, you know, Klon Erlinger are importing London spectacles and they have to rebuild the whole stage to fit right. them. So it's just, you know, it's interesting. It's like this, it's sort of a further extension of this nostalgia era mixed with the high concept
right.
Physical production that's manifesting itself. Anyway, just I mean, that's all a theoretical thought.
Well, no, I agree with you. I mean, you see the cycle in the art form, you know, it goes from simple to complicated till someone says, oh, you know, it'd be better if we just kept it simple, and they keep it simple, and then it gets bigger again. And like someone says, oh, we should keep it simple. And the same thing happens over and over yeah, again. Yeah. If you look at Broadway shows, I mean, that's the story of Broadway and probably, you know, film too. But there's two other ones. So there's one other one. We talked about Audra. We talked about Grind and the drawing that we have in the exhibition from Grind. If you look at no other drawing in the show, Leilani Jones and Grind is one of the great drawings of this exhibition. Great Friday drawing, and the only person who could do it was Hirschfeld. The last show I want to talk about is Mama, I Want to Sing, which is the longest running off-Broadway show, a Black off-Broadway show in the history of the theater. I don't think anybody was rushing with a Pulitzer Prize for the script. I don't think it's necessarily a great show, but it's a popular show. You know, it struck a chord with audiences. Played for 8 or 9 years uptown in Harlem, and then toured this country, toured Europe and Asia.
Millions of dollars for its creator / performer / producer.
Right.
I mean, it's an interesting piece. I didn't see it, and I haven't. Read it. I've heard some of it, and I've seen I've seen little bits of it. I just find it an interesting production. It's not something that I point to specifically,
right?
But and I think it was a very specific and a specific piece with a specific audience and a specific time. And I guess it's I'm curious to learn the whole story about it because I feel like I don't know the whole story, but as I understand it, and certainly what I've read about it, it started out at Amas Musical Theater, in actually 1980 and only made it into a couple performances because then it was shut down because there was a dispute over, future royalties who was involved, and so from a production standpoint, I find it curious because then it pops up 3 years later with the same central person who is a performer, producer with her husband, and author with her husband.
Right.
And yet the composer has changed and the music team has changed. So it's like, it's one of those things where I'm like, I'm a little skeptical to know what the full story is.
Yeah.
And I don't, so I don't, you know, I can't speak to it definitively, but it's a curious piece and, you know, they made a sequel out of it. They made another show called Let the Music.
I think there's three.
It's three of them. Yeah. Let the Music Play Gospel is the third one.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the other thing that's really curious about it, which to me, which is part of the reason that I'm just sort of skeptical about the entry as well, is it was apparently playing in city-owned theater that was had been vacant, that was meant for not-for-profit productions.
Mm.
And so then the city wanted them out, or there was some dispute with the city, you know, 5 years into the run.
Right.
Which they ultimately won, as I understand it. And then the city appealed. And so the show closes while it was still running, I assume healthily. I can't speak to the full story, but I assume it was, they were running until 1991 when they closed. And they closed because because of the dispute. But what's interesting is the dynamics of the dispute, because in an op-ed or a letter from the city, they're saying that this woman who's, enterprise it is.
By Higginson.
It's become a multi-million dollar enterprise that is operating on a lease that they had from 1983 for this, what is supposed to be a nonprofit theater.
Yeah.
I guess the theater is purporting that she had not paid rent since 1988.
Wow.
And then they offered her a deal too, to extend the lease and to work out an arrangement for rent if there was, but she rejected the deal. I have not taken a dive deeper into it than what has been published about it. But
so
it,
please it don't sue us.
Say it again.
Please don't sue us. You know,
don't
sue,
if, right,
by
yeah,
Higginson,
exactly.
If you're listening, please don't sue us.
That's the disclaimer. Yes. You know, so I'm curious to know what the full story is, but so, you know, I think it's an interesting piece. I'm always hesitant to say to do declarative longest running statements,
yes,
or first statements, because you can always, there's always the question of will you be disproven. So I don't.
True.
It existed, and they apparently did very well in their Uptown Theater. With the audience to whom they marketed.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Well, what's the Black theater, or certainly musical theater, coming down the road, or performers or composers we should be thinking about? You know, what are the shows that would fit into this criteria that we haven't heard about, or, you know, we'll be talking about 20 years from now?
Shows meaning in process or recent
shows? Well, shows or performers shows that you think audiences should know about. There's none. Maybe you don't know. I'm not.
No.
Maybe
you don't have. I think there.
What you? If you don't have a crystal ball, then you know we've been lied to.
Yeah. Exactly. No. There are many. I think most. I will say. Unfortunately, I'm not familiar with his work. But I know a lot of folks are very supportive and enjoy Michael Jackson's work.
Oh yeah, sure.
There's
the other Michael Jackson.
Say it again.
The other Michael Jackson.
The other Michael Jackson. Correct. The one that is still living.
Yes.
Yes.
And has no charges of pedophilia against him.
Right. Kirsten Childs. I'm not sure what she's working on right now. I know she has a couple projects that she had told me she's working on. I have been off the news radar actually for the last several months, so something may have
haven't
popped
we
up
all
about them, right? So I'm not, I don't know. But I think there, you know, there are a number of individuals. I would be curious to see a new Stu musical, frankly.
Right.
But I know Lynn Nottage is working on. I think she's working on another piece. Yes. In fact, she's working on a piece with Susan Birkenhead, who is not black. We should point out. And they did Secret Life of Bees together. But there's another project they're working on, I believe, with George C. Wolfe.
Of course, her Intimate Apparel has been turned into sort of a mini opera.
Right. Is that Ricky Ian Gordon?
Yes. Ricky Ian Gordon. Who's not black.
Who is not black, right. And speaking of not black, Susan Birkenhead is basically black. Because she, basically, I mean, her repertoire is so.
I think I have some shirts that are basically black.
Basically, right. I love Susan Birkenhead's lyrics. I think she's a terrific lyric writer, and she happens to have written a number of musicals about black subject matter. I mean, I think there are a number of people and a number of interesting projects toward which I'm looking forward and hopeful to see, you know, and I'm sure many that I don't even know about right now, but just, you know, I mean, musicals in progress. Right. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out.
Sure. Well, is there anything that we didn't touch on that you think we should touch on?
Anything we didn't touch on? I mean, well, there's so much. Right. But I mean, just
but
in the
we've
world.
Been talking for about 2 hours now, so I've
I know. I always just mention Bob Cole because I refer to him as the father of black musical theater. But his career ended tragically, in fact, before Al Hirschfeld would have been working, unfortunately.
Right. So much of that early black theater history was not recorded by Hirschfeld because he simply was not doing this work then. Mm. It's not till December 26 that he first starts drawing the theater.
Interesting.
Well, this has been great, Ben. We really, really appreciate you coming by and telling us more than we knew before.
Please.
You know, you have a real knowledge where what we know about Hirschfeld is kind of what you know about the American musical. And that's great for us. You know, that's what we're interested in. And I like to think that anybody who's listening is interested in. So your book is called The American Musical?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that's being published by Routledge in 2022?
Correct, 2022. Very excited. And it will be about the form itself, encompassing all, you know, writers of all shades, as it were.
Right. and then what about, do you have any, I know that you have created a number of stage shows drawing on the history of the musical theater. Do you have any of those coming up or working on a new one?
I do not, no. The most immediate things for me are the book, which I'm in the midst of writing.
Sure.
And then I'm very excited next year. This is not a stage show, but it is, obviously it's theater related. There is going to be opening a Museum of Broadway, will be in the Times Square area. Unfortunately, I can't reveal any more than that.
Oh, no, we've been working with them too. They approached us.
Yeah,
wonderful people involved.
Terrific, yeah. I'm very excited about the
concept. It is not going to be your grandmother's Museum of Broadway.
No, it'd be very, very cool. They have, I mean, the immersive element has been revealed, I think. So that's not it'll be more of an immersive guided experience. But I guess one of the things I'm excited about is that it sort of marries the commercial immersive element with the historical content. Right. Element, so which is, and I'm working more on the latter part of that. I'm excited about that. So I think it should be a really excellent venture.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they seem like they were getting close to, you know, getting all the things lined up, and then of course the pandemic hit. So we don't know when we'll ever be able to go back out and be with other people.
I know. Hopefully soon. And hopefully it won't affect the timeline too much.
Yeah.
So.
becomes part of the timeline.
You know,
the year
indeed.
We didn't have Broadway.